People vanish from our lives on a regular basis, some of them coming and going so quickly that it's like passing them on the other side of a revolving glass door where you're going in opposite directions. We hardly knew them, if at all, as we simply came into contact for a short time before departing forever. Whether it's the person who sat next to us on the airplane, the client who visited the office one day, or the bartender who served us at the tropical resort. At the opposite extreme of that spectrum, there are others who enter our lives and find a long-standing place within it, such as a spouse, a child, or even a close friend. Yet no matter the relationship we have with any of them, there always comes a day when it all ends, when time and circumstances bring change that tears us apart. It could happen by way of death, taking a new job, falling out of love, or parting after sharing a seat beside someone on a train. But regardless of how it takes place, we're left to wonder where they've gone, and often come to terms with the notion that they're never coming back. This even happens when we look at our young faces in the mirror day after day and realize that slowly but surely, every identity we've ever tried to assign ourselves in permanence was ravaged by time. Our 4-year-old faces and bodies aren't the same as when we're 20, and by 80, we certainly aren't the same person we were at 40 either. It offers a stark reality that we are not just this single person we imagine ourselves to be, but a collection of identities being revealed in sequence, one in which we are born, blossom, wither, and finally die, unable to keep our grasp upon the answer to the greatest and most profound question we'll ever ask ourselves in this lifetime, which is, who am I? We are continuously robbed of those identities by aging, and given the necessity of change that accompanies it, until which point we reach the end and resign ourselves to the peaceful but sad conclusion that, in death, we must no longer fight for an identity. We can let go. When we have definitively reached the end of anything, whether it's a sporting event culminating in a loss, the last day of summer, a failed romantic relationship, or even death, we find ways to come to terms with the finality because we understand the circumstances as they've been presented to us and know that we must move on. We have no choice. But sometimes, on the rare occasion, a person disappears from our lives, and rather being able to look them up on social media years later, or in the case of death, visit their grave, we're left in total ignorance of what became of them, and therefore are denied any type of closure we seek. We remain haunted by the pain and uncertainty of not knowing, and tortured by the vicious cycle of pleasure and pain afforded by desperately holding on to hope that we'll one day know the answer. Nowhere is this more prevalent than in true crime cases in which a family loses one of their own to a strange, mysterious, and totally inexplicable disappearance, one where the person's whereabouts or fate can't be properly ascertained. But what's worse is that sometimes they are recovered, even if deceased by that time, and the true answer to what happened and why still escapes us. Such is the case of 18-year-old Joshua Maddox. Josh grew up in Woodland Park, Colorado, which is considered a quaint bedroom community located within the Colorado Springs metropolitan area. Featuring a population of approximately 8,000 residents, Woodland Park resides adjacent to Pike National Forest, which is comprised of perhaps 1 million acres of nature, including forested areas and mountains, the most recognizable of which is Pike's Peak. The elevation varies between 8,200 and 10,000 feet, making it a place where spring and summer weather, despite being warm during the day, can still be cool or even cold at night. Needless to say, this is a region with an abundance of outdoor activities, from skiing and snowboarding to hiking and fishing. So, Josh Maddox lives with his parents in town, and while attending high school there, he was known as a very nice kid who placed kindness at the forefront of his identity, yet also had a bit of an eccentric side, as it said he sometimes wore a top hat to school and carried a briefcase into classes with him. He clearly had a creative side, further evidenced by the fact that he had created and often worked on his own comic strip. He also seemed to enjoy playing the guitar and writing stories. Plus, given his location, he loved nature, and especially taking walks around town and elsewhere through the surrounding forestry, along with fishing and hunting. At this time, being 18 years old, Josh had just reached adulthood and stood at 6 feet, weighing 150 pounds, so he was on the taller side and very thin. Prior to his disappearance, Josh lived with his mother and father, along with his sisters Ruth and Kate. But there was something missing, an absence that had deeply affected Josh over the past 2 years, which was his brother Zachary's suicide, which occurred when Zach was 18 and Josh 16, specifically right before the elder sibling was set to graduate high school in June 2006. For all intents and purposes, he seemed to be a lot like his younger brother in the sense that he was noted for his kindness, creativity, and love of the outdoors, having been a talented guitarist and drummer, as well as an expert fly fisherman. Sadly, Zach, as he was known, suffered from challenges related to his mental health, and his obituary specifically states, quote, "After years of struggle, Zachary succumbed to an unreasoning depression against which he had no defense," end quote. And while it's a bit morbid to mention the following fact, I think it's important to note that Zach killed himself inside the family home. I don't know the method utilized in the act, but it would be a safe assumption that Josh could have been the person who discovered the body, or even if it wasn't him, he might have witnessed it after the fact, whether being summoned by another family member, such as a sibling, or when an ambulance arrived, along with a police presence, to take the deceased away. I'm not sure. We have to remember that the trauma is twofold in the sense of trauma caused by the loss and absence on one hand, and then trauma caused by the incident itself on the other. Trauma resulting from loss and absence, such as what happened here, is often closely associated with grief leading way to depression, while trauma derived from the terrible memories of the incident can often cause PTSD, which is also accompanied by depression. With that said, it shouldn't come as any surprise that Josh's father said his younger son had experienced a deep sense of grief in the two-year period following Zach's suicide, though Josh did seem to be making progress. But where this assessment fails, and where retellings of this story often fail as well, is in neglecting to mention that once something like this happens in your family, and you both see the pain it causes the other members, and feel it for yourself, if you too begin to suffer from similar symptoms likely to lead toward the same fate, you have a greater propensity to do what? Hide those feelings, and specifically because you want to protect the people you love. And if you reached the point that those feelings couldn't be managed any longer and were on the verge of deciding to take your own life, knowing the absolute devastation your family would be put through repeating the process with another son and brother, and were especially predisposed to being a kind person, you might think it's better to relieve them of ever knowing that that's what happened. Josh's brother Zach killed himself in the home and was immediately found, leaving them hopeless and grieving a huge loss. So if you wanted to reverse those values, you would go outside the home, not be found, and allow hope to remain. Zach left their lives in a definitive and decisive way that quickly established that he was gone and never coming back, as it was proven by his death. But Josh will disappear in a way that attempts to prevent that from happening. It disguises his body from being found, outside the home, and in a manner that his family can remain hopeful that he'll return someday. Josh's father, Mike, said that when Zach took his own life, the loss was so painful to Josh that it pushed him over the edge. So what I see here is that he had been free-falling off that cliff for 2 years, and on this fateful morning of the walk where he disappears, he finally hit the ground below. Now, on the morning of May 8, 2008, Josh tells one of his sisters that he's going out for a walk alone, something he did frequently to gather his thoughts and contemplate life, especially in the wake of his older brother's death. Many of us do this. We find ourselves with a greater sense of peace and silence in nature, a place where the hustle and bustle of our daily routines is reduced to a singular focus that allows us to see our lives with greater clarity, and therefore more easily make decisions and come to terms with things that otherwise seem irreconcilable against our circumstances. A common phrase we use for this purpose is, to clear my head. And it simply speaks to sifting through the clutter in our minds in order to embrace what is truly important and discard what isn't, in the same manner as cleaning an attic, but on a purely emotional and intellectual level. Josh departs the family home that morning, but as the hours pass and the sun descends below the horizon, bringing the night to bear, it becomes more and more apparent to Josh's family that something is wrong. Over the next 5 days, they'll go out looking for him in the woods and around town, while also checking in with his friends, but they can't find him, so ultimately the decision is made to call the police and report him missing. Now, in a lot of coverage of this case elsewhere, that decision to not report Josh missing for 5 days is often criticized, and specifically in the context of the family needing to be more concerned, and the police being allowed to pursue leads before the trail goes cold. But I think the better position to take here is to avoid the criticism and proceed to analyze the decision outside the framework of right and wrong. If Josh's family delayed the decision for 5 days, it's likely for 2 reasons. 1, he's officially an adult and has the right to walk away without explanation, whether he plans to come back or not. And 2, it says he's likely done similar things before. When people are hurting badly on a psychological level without relief, they are emotionally unable to attain a sense of distance, or better yet, breathing room, from those haunting emotional places in their heads. And since they can't escape psychologically, they often reverse that idea into physicality as a substitute and in a desperate attempt to get away. There are countless true crime stories where people who are suffering from mental illness finally break from reality and make a run for it physically. This is common among people indulging extreme drug use, as well as those suffering from psychosis, who are quite often one and the same. They reach the point of a mental breakdown, a point of crisis from which they feel they can't go forward, and their only option left at that moment of coming to a psychological standstill is to proceed to run away from the thoughts physically. But in the end, when this desperate attempt fails to accommodate in providing space from the mental anguish, a harrowing truth emerges, which is that the only way to stop the thoughts is death. And that's why we have suicide. Now, a very important element of this process involves understanding why psychosis plays such a large role in so many of these mental breaks. It's something that is often ignored and results in observers of all types standing around and scratching their heads when reason and logic fail to accommodate the narratives they've created for why the person disappeared. If you go on Reddit or similar platforms, you will find threads with endless speculation and from a multitude of perspectives, all utilizing reason and logic born of the conscious mind and social implications as a tool for solving this riddle. But the fatal mistake in doing so is that, if a person has reached the point of a psychological breakdown, it means, by default of its construction, that both reason and logic failed the victim, and they abandoned it in favor of a state of mind in which they were rendered vulnerable to psychosis. At that point, as reason and logic have failed, the brain, or more appropriately, the mind, is going to abandon actions conducive to the conscious mind and instead adopt an alternative way forward consistent with how the unconscious mind operates. But why does the mind do that? Well, the answer is straightforward. A person on the verge of suicide, or at least running away from who they are, is sending a very clear message to the mind that says exactly this. I don't want to be this person anymore. I am abandoning my current identity. And yet, unlike a person with normal brain function who declares this in an act of evolution, such as someone who says they're going to quit smoking and subsequently becomes a non-smoker, the mind, in this case, has no path forward for devolution. Without a roadmap for where it's going psychologically, in terms of identity, such as going from being the smoker to the non-smoker, there is no identity for it to adopt, and therefore no plan it can accommodate to evolve. So instead of moving forward psychologically, its values are forced to reverse or mirror in the sense that it goes backward physically. It knows the place from which you've come, going all the way back to your earliest identity as a fetus inside the mother's womb. So if you deny it a path forward, just like a person reaching a roadblock while driving along a street, it has no choice but to turn around and go back to the place from which it came, which will ultimately result in death because the darkness and lack of life at the beginning and end of our lives are essentially the same thing. Psychosis embodies many symptoms, but is most often defined in a general sense as the state of a person being disconnected from reality. And that's exactly what happens when we abandon reason and logic. Reason and logic are fuel for our social survival, and without them, or without indulging the conscious mind, we can only utilize structure or design, as the conscious mind is built for the purpose of drama, by way of varying and oppositional perspectives derived from differing reason and logic. But beneath that facade, in our genetic coding, or DNA, there is only structure. It's a difference between how something is experienced in society and built in design. Now, within that consideration of structure, our universe is comprised, in terms of design, by way of symbols, the most basic and fundamental of which are the 1 and 0 of binary coding, or straight line and circle. So, when we see someone suffering psychosis embracing a narrative conducive to the operation of the unconscious mind, it's symbolic in nature, as it is unfolding by way of design elements, not reason and logic. So let's watch this play out in relation to Josh Maddox's disappearance. Josh's family, as we talked about, called the police and reported him missing after 5 days. The police recognized Josh as an adult, given he was 18 at the time, but gave the family the courtesy of creating a missing persons poster in order to try to drum up some good leads as to Josh's whereabouts. The effort was mostly fruitless, but there was supposedly a rumor going around the local high school that Josh attended that one of the students he recently hung out with had been bragging about murdering him. The cops apparently found no merit in these assertions, but we should say that this person did go on to actually murder someone. Of course, when he was arrested, he also claimed that he murdered another person, and when the cops looked into it, it turned out that he lied about that. So there really is no merit to the fact that this person might have killed Josh, and certainly no evidence. So for now, we're just going to move on past that. So nobody can find Josh at this point. He was not witnessed by anyone along his walk after leaving the family's home on the morning of May 8, 2008, and of course was also not witnessed in the company of another person at that time either. That should have been a clue that Josh very likely didn't go far from home and that he wouldn't have been accompanied by anyone. Yet interested parties searched near and far, uncovering no clues. He had not mentioned that he was leaving town or even staying somewhere else in it. More than 7 years pass, and suddenly it's August 7th, 2015, meaning Josh's family has gone all that time without any answer as to where their son and brother is, nor did they even have any legitimate leads to follow. It was a baffling, unsolved mystery, one that took a heavy emotional toll on the family, leaving them all with various reactions, from one sister believing Josh ran away to live his best life somewhere, to his father wondering if he had just gone the way of his older brother Zach and taken his own life. But on this hot summer day, a construction crew gathered outside an abandoned cabin only 2 blocks from Josh's home, a distance described specifically as a quarter mile. It was at a place previously called Thunderhead Ranch, which was operated by a man named Bert Bergstrom, also known as Big Bert, from the 1930s through the 1950s. There was a main building on the property that was used for dining, drinking, gambling, and allegedly prostitution during that era, while the small cabin in question was nearby. The facility was closed, however, after Bergstrom was arrested by the FBI and put on trial. At some point afterward, a man named Chuck Murphy purchased the ranch and allowed his brother to live in the cabin for the next 30 years, until the sibling finally left in 2005. It was then that Chuck refrained from maintaining the space and simply boarded up the windows and proceeded to use it as storage. In the 3 years after this time, the cabin fell into a state of disrepair and was subjected to the occasional break-in, not only by people, but also by animals seeking shelter from the cold. It was essentially no longer inhabitable by 2008 when Josh disappeared, and thus Chuck had very little reason to go inside the cabin or scrutinize the contents within it. By the summer of 2015, however, Chuck Murphy had decided to demolish the old cabin as it no longer served any purpose, and on August 7th, the crew had begun the process. From a structural standpoint, the most difficult, or perhaps demanding, aspect of the demolition would be the brick chimney that led to a fireplace below in the cabin, one that featured a metal insert called a heat-elator. A heat-elator sits inside the firebox and is often form-fitted to the dimensions of the firebox and the flue above it. Now, the purpose of installing a heat-elator is to maximize the efficiency of the fireplace. For instance, when using a traditional fireplace, a significant amount of heat is lost to the necessary draft that draws the flames and smoke upward toward the open flue above it, meaning that you often have to be close to the fireplace to enjoy the warmth it provides. To the contrary, a heat-elator insert features a circulator that redirects hot air back into the room, something that is important for structures without traditional and modern heating options, such as heat provided by central air or radiators. Of course, Chuck Murphy had actually built this brick chimney as an add-on to the cabin long ago, and when doing so, he installed a crisscrossing rebar grate near the top, specifically one row of bricks below the top row. These days, we normally utilize caps made of either galvanized or stainless steel in order to prevent rain or snow melt from entering the flue, but back then, it was common to use grates or wire mesh across the top as a means of preventing animals like squirrels and raccoons from entering the structure. So at the top of this chimney, there is a rebar grate preventing entry. This type of rebar is normally comprised of galvanized steel, or zinc-coated steel, offering resistance to rust, though the presence of moisture from rain and snow break down the coating and lead to rust anyway. However, even if rebar gets rusty, its thickness generally ensures it will not break down significantly over time, meaning that if Chuck Murphy placed a rebar grate at the top of the chimney when he built it, the chances are really good that it was still there and also still strong enough to block the path down in 2015. The demolition crew enters the cabin with Chuck on August 7, 2015, and all parties immediately notice a terrible stench that could most easily be described as death. Though Chuck notes that since the cabin had been abandoned 3 years earlier and animals had made their way in to seek shelter, that it was normal for the interior to stink of smells of that type. The workers find that at some point, a breakfast bar from one side of the cabin had been removed from the wall where it was attached and subsequently placed directly in front of the fireplace. They needed to tear out the fireplace insert or heat-o-later, and so they move it out of the way, making the stench even more apparent than it had been prior. It's only then they see some items on the floor in front of the fireplace that had been hidden by the presence of the breakfast bar. Behind the place where the breakfast bar sat, but still outside the fireplace, they discover a pair of pants, a pair of socks, and underwear, all of which are reported to be neatly folded and seem to have been there for quite some time. Afterward, they tear out the fireplace insert and proceed to demolish the chimney, but in the process, they make a harrowing discovery that immediately stops them in their tracks. Inside the chimney flue, above the location of the fireplace insert, or heat-o-later, is a partially mummified human body, which is wedged upside down in the cramped space and nude from the waist down, while wearing only a thermal shirt above the waist. The remains are arranged in the fetal position, with the knees drawn up to the chest and the head pointing down. Chuck Murphy proceeds to call the police and report the discovery, and also asserts that he has no recollection of himself or anyone else ever removing the breakfast bar from a nearby wall and placing it in front of the fireplace. As he had not entered the cabin in a long time, he had not noticed this change prior to the time of the demolition. Yet Chuck, the demolition crew, and police were still left baffled by this discovery, as it didn't make much sense. With a grate at the top of the chimney, a person would not have been able to descend the flue from above. It would be understandable if someone either curious or seeking shelter decided to break into the cabin and got stuck going down. But with the presence of the clothes inside the cabin, to the contrary, it suggested this person had actually already been inside, had no reason to break in by way of descending, and even stranger, decided to go up the chimney from the bottom. While someone thin might stand a chance of entering through the bottom and squeezing through the insert's damper into the flue, anyone attempting to place another person there for the purpose of concealment would be severely hard-pressed to do so. It would seem a nearly impossible feat. For context, if you want to look at a case in which someone actually did go down a chimney flue and get stuck, check out the Harley Dilly case from Ohio, in which a teen went down a chimney, became stuck, and subsequently passed away. It's a much different circumstance, and you'll see the difference between that case and this one. So, if no outside party had attempted to conceal this body in the context of a murder or similar wrongdoing leading to death, then for all intents and purposes, it would seem the victim had done it to himself. But who would do that? And better yet, why? The medical examiner, upon examining the body and testing the remaining tissue, reached a conclusion that despite the fact that this victim suffered a prolonged and agonizing death in his opinion, there were no signs of drug use or foul play. He assessed the death as an accident, one in which he believed the victim had attempted to break into the abandoned cabin by shimmying down the flue and subsequently got stuck. But he reached that conclusion unaware of the metal grate at the top. In the absence of that possibility, everybody was essentially stumped as to what had occurred, and more importantly, Why? What was definitive, however, was the true identity of the victim. It was Josh Maddox. As his family had been left to suffer the despair and uncertainty of losing their son and brother to something they could not understand, and wondered where he possibly could have gone, the truth was that his long walk into nothingness was, ironically, only two short blocks down the road. It speaks volumes to why nobody had seen him along the way, or even witnessed him at any point during that fateful day. 7 years. That's a long time. And at that point, while the closure of certainty is reached in relation to death, so begins the grieving process all over again, and for a family that had already lost one of their own to a suicide. It seems surreal at best, and at worst, so cruel that one is left helpless to understand why. Nonetheless, it was true, and what's worse is that, despite knowing where Josh went and that he was dead, they didn't know how or even why, and to this day, still have no answers. I can only imagine it takes a tremendous amount of courage and fortitude to proceed under those circumstances. But if we step back from the horrifying consideration of the emotional pain and suffering his family must have endured, we are more easily able to recognize the reasons why he would do his best to prevent them from experiencing that. We could choose to believe the concealment aspect of this crime suggests foul play, but there is simply no evidence of that. So perhaps the concealed nature of this scene instead suggests a desire to keep it a secret in order to protect people from getting hurt on an emotional level. If the body is never found, then there's still hope, no matter how little. But once it is uncovered, the hope doubles down on the family's suffering. There was no evidence of a murder taking place. The toxicology report also failed to uncover any drugs in Josh's system. If Josh had attempted to break into the cabin by sliding down the chimney and got stuck, we could assess this as potentially an unfortunate accident. But the evidence doesn't establish these things as true. To the contrary, the evidence suggests Josh Maddox entered the cabin, removed his clothes, and climbed into the chimney from the bottom, where he ultimately died from what the medical examiner believed was likely exposure, specifically hypothermia. The temperature was supposedly in the low 40s on the night Josh disappeared, and in the following days likely would have been similar. As nobody inhabited the cabin, and there were no neighbors close enough to hear cries for help from the interior of the chimney, any attempt he would have made to be rescued from this fate would have been fruitless. So at this point, we're left with more questions than answers. If Josh willingly climbed into the chimney, why did he do that? And if he did, why was he driven to endure what would have been an agonizing and prolonged death, whether it happened over the course of hours or days? Plus, why would he have removed his clothes before entering the chimney? And beyond that, why did he leave the shirt on his body while removing everything else? If he was on the verge of committing something so horrible as a means of suicide, wouldn't he have seemed to be in a state of distress before he left when his sister encountered him saying he was going for a walk? And if he did intentionally take his own life, why is the method so unconventional and indicative of prolonging the suffering instead of ending his suffering, as we see in most other suicides, such as gunshots, overdoses, and slit wrists, which allow a victim to reduce either the pain or the time in which they have to suffer before dying? This makes no sense. And it shouldn't. When a suicide is the result of a rational choice, the act and subsequently the reasoning behind it are generally attainable by way of reason and logic. But When the end comes as a result of something irrational, such as a psychotic state, reason and logic are abandoned so that, even though the end still comes, the means are no longer rational. The means come instead as something driven by a symbolic narrative, and it's in these cases that we must indulge physical movement rather than emotional choices in determining how and why this person perpetrated the act. At this point, it's likely that most of us can't find a rational explanation for how Josh ended up stuffed in the chimney, given the circumstances and evidence. He couldn't have come down the chimney from the top, whether by his own means or by way of a perpetrator placing him there. And with the only other point of entry being the bottom of the chimney at the point of the heat-elator insert, it seems equally unreasonable that Josh was stuffed up into the chimney through the damper, or even climbed up there himself. So without rational means at our disposal, let's explore the irrational. We'll start with Josh's psychological disposition. We ask, where is he in life? So we can assess the type of thought process he would indulge. Of course, Josh is a teen, specifically 18 years old, the approximate age of a high school graduate either going off to college, heading out into the world to find a job, or joining the military. We could easily define this period as one in which a person comes of age, particularly in the form of finding purpose. But one of the most difficult aspects of being on the precipice of adulthood in this manner is that so many of us enter this phase of life with unresolved childhood trauma, and so, as our bodies continue to mature and the dates on the calendar continue to roll forward in an inevitable future that extracts your dependent childhood and introduces an adult life consistent with independence, we end up with a mind or emotional world clinging desperately to the past in that place of unresolved trauma, waiting to heal, but a future demanding that we move forward now. And of course, the path to healing that childhood trauma comes in the form of embracing change, or the path to adulthood, by engaging in activities, from a career to your love life, that will ultimately result in creating a new identity geared toward overcoming the trauma, or, we could say, killing the old childhood identity and taking on the new adult one. That embodies the concept of the redundant bees I talked about. You have a childhood body, or old self, that merges with your adult body, or new self, during those formative teen years, a time in which you will be torn apart and put back together again, leaving a different person in the mirror at its culmination than the one you witnessed in the same place at the start. In order to complete the transformation, your emotional world has to accommodate the same level or rate of growth to match the changes in the body, and with that, you go from being torn apart to being whole again. The child dies, both physically and mentally, giving way to the adult. Now, the physical changes are inevitable. They are biologically guaranteed. However, the psychological changes come about through decisions. Yet, if something horrible happened to you in childhood that is unresolved, you might find yourself unwilling to let go of the past and instead waiting in that place emotionally, hoping for healing. You become stuck, and likely because you either don't have the will to proceed or don't have a plan, and in many cases, it's both, as lack of will precludes creating a plan. And while this type of stagnancy is common, the worst or most harmful versions of it stem from trauma derived from irreconcilable circumstances. For instance, if you come from a home where you were mistreated by a parent, you can become a good parent in adulthood and find a great deal of healing through putting yourself into the role that failed you and then projecting the love and care you didn't receive upon your own child, who can then be afforded the experience you were denied. Or you might have had a parent who said you'll never amount to anything, and it gave you the ambition to succeed and make a name for yourself. But in the case of Joshua Maddox, the circumstances are irreconcilable in the sense that his brother Zach died and isn't ever coming back. And that's a really difficult thing, because you get stuck in that place emotionally. But the days, months, and years passing by begin to add tremendous pressure to move on, as does your changing face in the mirror. Your physical world is pushing you out of childhood like a locomotive barreling down the tracks, but your emotional world is still standing on these tracks in the way of the train about to be run over. You can't replace your cherished brother and feel like you can't go on without him. As you remain in that place emotionally but are forced to continue physically, your emotional world gets run over by that locomotive and remains in that place on the tracks, wounded and dying, but the train keeps on going full speed ahead, which means the gap is going to continue to widen between your physical and emotional worlds. The wider the gap gets, the more predisposed you become to finding physical solutions for emotional problems, which is why we have endless prison systems full of emotionally traumatized men who have resorted to crime instead of emotional growth to compensate for childhood trauma. The longer you wait, the harder it is to catch up. For instance, childhood trauma holding you back at 18 becomes a much more serious problem if it continues until you're 30, as that physical gap, in the form of time, renders a distance too far for a lot of people in terms of being able to close the gap and finally reach a point of healing with unity between body and mind. The obvious problem is that when you're wounded and feel like you're dying emotionally, stuck there on those tracks, you can't find the strength to get up and run after the train. You have to build that strength through becoming someone else who can run, little by little, day by day, with small changes ultimately leading to big ones. That takes strength. In Josh's case, what he lost and can't retrieve is the experience of growing to an adult with his brother, and by way of his brother's suicide, and perhaps combined with genetic considerations as well, he too began to succumb to grief, depression, and the lack of will necessary to go on. He began to mirror the qualities his brother Zach exuded prior to his death. And so, without the emotional capacity to go on, and only physical means left at his disposal, the only way he can accommodate having a shared experience with his brother is to compensate physically by way of death. His brother died as a teen, at the same age, and as they are seemingly both suffering a similar emotional ailment, a physical solution suffices. If they can't have that shared emotional experience, they'll have a physical one. That's the story that an irrational symbolic narrative will craft. If emotional growth moves us forward, physical means will take us back. If you again examine the prison system, you'll see that same formula. As a prisoner, you replace your childhood home with a prison and live under the roof of authority figures who make the rules for you. In the same way parents control their children at home, the prison will dictate what you eat and when, what bedtime is, and how you're expected to behave in the house, while handing down a sentence similar to a child being grounded. It's men being treated like children, and it happens because we have a strong propensity for going back physically when we can't proceed emotionally. Now, we have to take a quick look at biological considerations related to that idea because this will be the basis for the irrational choice Josh seems to have made. As a fetus in the womb, the first thing we ever know is the safety, comfort, and warmth of that place, one shrouded in darkness that shields us from the horrors of the outside world, and specifically from the idea of disunity between body and mind. It's known that, in the same way a black hole operates in the universe, with space inside it being exchanged for time and space outside it, the fetus experiences only the concept of space inside the mother's womb until birth, when time is introduced and finally realized by the child. Time, of course, is a disembodied entity that is projected physically through aging and movement, combining in a form called change. And so begins the process of a child needing to emotionally move or mature to accommodate physical growth and greater movement. Only prior to birth do we enjoy that unity between body and mind. From the moment of birth, we must change emotionally to keep pace with the changes in our physical world, or we could say changes caused by time. So if you're Josh in this phase of your life where your physical growth is a runaway train that has left the counterpart of your emotional world in the dust, leaving you feeling as though you can't catch up and close the gap through rational means of change, irrational means, or symbolic means, remain the only option for going back. In the case of a criminal, while the person's means are antisocial, they are still perfectly rational. If you kill somebody during a robbery to get their money instead of getting a job, your actions are illegal and antisocial and even cruel, but they are still born of rational thought. The money you acquire will be equally valuable to the money you would have earned at a job and can be spent like it too. It's important to remember the criminal doesn't see their circumstances as irreconcilable. They see crime as an option for compensating in this case. On the other hand, if your circumstances are perceived as irreconcilable, such as Josh suffering from disunity between body and mind, stuck in that place in time when his brother died, the irrational choice is to close the gap by turning around and going back the way you came, which is the beginning. And even from an irrational standpoint, it seems strange that someone's brain would see going backward as an alternative to going forward. But the truth we now understand about time is that, while we experience it in a three-dimensional context in everyday life, rendering a linear narrative in which one event leads to the next, giving us past, present, and future, the fundamental construction of time is rendered in a cyclical way, or infinite loop, so the end and beginning are essentially one and the same. Linear time is an experiential element. Cyclical time is a structural element. So when descending into psychosis, what often occurs is that rational, experiential reason and logic are substituted with irrational structure and design. Now, obviously, going back is also meant to symbolically erase the irreconcilable emotional wound by predating when it occurred. But the catch is that, no matter how far back you go, the person who died and caused this wound still isn't coming back. So you keep going until the point at which you can go no further, which is the beginning. And also, as the beginning, it's synonymous with the end, which are one and the same. In terms of our perceived consciousness or emotional world, you find the same darkness, ignorance, and peace after the end of life as you'd find before the beginning prior to birth. And within that, the truth arises that the only way to erase irreconcilable emotional pain is to no longer be alive. So in the womb, when a male fetus is born as a baby, he is essentially evicted from that place and traumatized by that action. From that point on, as he grows physically and emotionally, he will drift physically farther and emotionally further from his mother's protection and resources, at first remaining right by her side and often nursing directly from her body, yet slowly but surely move away from her arms and out of her reach toward greater independence as he grows. Upon reaching puberty and the onset of the beginnings of what will become adulthood, the heterosexual boy becoming a man will stray from his mother's love and move toward the love of another woman in the role of a romantic partner or lover. At that point, he will be driven to get back inside the place from which he was born, but with the irony that he cannot get back inside the womb to his mother's protection. Rather, this desperate act of beating down that door at the womb, so to speak, will just result in the creation of a new fetus inside. So the only places in the cycle of life in which we finally find peace from the disunity between body and mind are the beginning and end, or prior to birth and after death, which, as I said, are structurally one and the same. And that brings us full circle to what was discovered inside the chimney at Chuck Murphy's cabin, and why. It's quite common for people suffering from unresolved trauma to wish they were never born, as the primary fundamental aspect of our emotional suffering within the context of the human condition is that we didn't choose this life or these circumstances or even these faces. They were chosen for us, whether the blame is placed upon human creators, such as our parents, or spiritual ones, such as God. Now let's join Josh Maddox on this walk from his home. He walks these 2 blocks, or about a quarter mile on that day, and is drawn to this abandoned cabin, specifically the chimney. The chimney flue has a metal rebar grate built into the bricks one row from the top, which, according to Chuck Murphy and the demolition crew, was still in place at this time. The windows of the cabin are boarded up, as the place is abandoned other than being used for storage, which we assume was simply storage of what amounted to junk, as the space wasn't heated by anything other than the unused fireplace. It wasn't a space that would be heated in the absence of people inhabiting it. Chuck suggested the cabin had been subjected to occasional break-ins in the past few years since his brother moved out, so it seems there was little to no security, and Josh wouldn't have had an issue getting inside or being noticed doing it. However, we should note there was no evidence, such as a ladder or other object placed against or next to the cabin, to suggest Josh was ever on the roof near the chimney. So let's say he breaks in at this point, as we seem to have ample evidence he was inside the cabin prior to his death, given that most of his clothing was found neatly folded on the floor outside the fireplace. Now picture him inside, but instead of operating under the context of rational thought, he has experienced a psychotic break and is now indulging a symbolic, irrational narrative consistent with physical imagery telling his emotional story. If he can't go on in life past the point of his brother's suicide and decides to go back, that ironic fate of colliding with both birth and death will come to bear, as the cycle of life dictates the beginning and end are one and the same. So why is he drawn to the chimney and in a context of nudity? Well, it starts with that concept of wishing you were never born, or getting back inside. As a baby, the wound is being unable to get back inside the womb to where it's warm and safe, by way of the birth canal. It's a place where there is no concept of time, only space, one where there is no longer a need or desire to go forward or backward. Rather, you remain. In life, within the framework of linear time, things move forward and backward from a centralized point between, again, giving us past, present, future. However, absent life in a three-dimensional space, there is no linear time, or time at all, as it is an experiential quality and not a design element fundamental to the universe's construction. So anything that is not physically realized within the universe only exists structurally and not in an experiential context. Therefore, Josh will exchange time and space here simply for space, and do so in a way that says he wants to be stuck in a place of peace or one absent existence, which occurs only at the beginning and end, which again are one and the same. That means we need to identify how his movements from this point on will give us both the beginning and end. Now, the theme, as we stated, is getting back inside, and in the context of the mother's womb. The mother's womb, on a grand scale, is the universe itself. It is the place in which the embodiment of our physical environment began, expanded, continues to evolve, and at a point billions of years into the future, will collapse, causing the embodiment within to evacuate and disappear in the same way as happens in a human pregnancy. Just like a woman having multiple children, the womb expands, the fetus evolves, and then transcends before the womb collapses and the cycle repeats. Now, as Josh stands here observing the fireplace with its heat-o-later insert, what is going to attract him on a symbolic or irrational level through physical means? Well, for that answer, we have to indulge some spirituality here. In biblical terms, there is something called the Day of the Lord, which, in the New Testament, serves as the ultimate and final judgment, the coming of Christ's kingdom. This is intended to take place at the culmination of history, or, as we've talked about, his story, meaning God's story. So the end of history indicates the end of embodiment, in the same way your TV screen, or even the movie theater, goes dark at the end of a movie you're watching. Embodiment is derived in a three-dimensional world by way of the color scale, specifically varying frequencies or vibrations from quantum fields that allow the presence of images to form, which are created by our eyes. Rather than these images existing absent our observation, they truthfully only exist by way of observation, as our eyes are designed to translate these vibrational frequencies into images. And with that considered, here's a quote from the Bible regarding the Day of the Lord. "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works in it will be burned up." So, on a scientific level, we also understand this to be true. As the universe ages and continues to expand, it will heat up, getting hotter and hotter, unable to cool itself, until which point it collapses or implodes, and everything within it, meaning all embodiment or images, will disappear. Now, that is the end, but ironically also the beginning, as life is derived from an infinite loop or cycle, making the end simply a new beginning. So only between this end and the new beginning is a place where nothing exists. So by Josh positioning himself in this place, it says he doesn't want to go forward and doesn't want to go back. It is both the beginning and end. So if Josh is in the cabin, he has been drawn to the idea of going back to that place between the beginning and end, the one in which darkness, silence, and peace exist, as there is nowhere outside these parameters where this is true. So he turns to the fireplace. Now, if his emotional wound, at its most basic level, is having been born into this life and these circumstances that have caused him pain, and has come from a dark place of warmth, or his mother's womb by way of the birth canal, then where will he go right now? The easy answer, again, is back inside, and in the context of the place between the beginning and end. Now, we just discussed the burning up of embodiment with the Day of the Lord. So where will we find that idea here in the cabin? The answer is in the fireplace with the wood. Our lives have been designed to be consistent with not only the universe's life cycle, but also that of a tree, as well as the changing seasons within the tree's existence that dictate its physical behavior. The tree has four phases of existence, which are birth, life, death, and rebirth, which we could also think of as the four seasons, or spring, summer, fall, and winter. A tree begins with a seed, which then does these things. It rises, branches out, leaves, and falls. In our lives, we even refer to the place we come from as our roots. So the tree grows tall, branches out, sheds its leaves, and then they fall, symbolically bringing about a death, leading to rebirth. So it follows the same pattern as our embodiment in human life. We start from a seed, grow tall, branch out, then eventually fall and leave our embodiment. That means the burning of wood is consistent with the day of the Lord. Red is the base of the color scale, right before the bookend of black, or nothingness, the absence of color and embodiment. So the burning of wood, by way of flames, is consistent with the end of our embodied world, as when the flame goes out, there is nothing but darkness. So when your fire dies in the fireplace at the culmination of the wood burning, red disappears and is replaced by darkness, or black, meaning the absence of embodiment makes the color scale unnecessary. Now, on the opposite end of the color scale, in terms of the counterpart bookend to black at the bottom, we have white at the top, which is the combination of all colors. So as someone who has worked on chimneys in the past, I can tell you that if your chimney is properly maintained in terms of cleaning, the smoke coming out the top should burn white and disappear. It is designed to work just as the idea of the embodiment of Christ or blood of Christ at the bottom of the chimney or color scale, rising to become the white light and disappearing as the body burns, in the same way as the Holy Trinity of Jesus becoming the Holy Spirit and subsequently disappearing as God to become disembodied. So in the chimney, we have the disembodiment at the bottom, rising as smoke, or Holy Ghost, and then disappearing in the vein of God, being disembodied above them. This structure is found throughout our world and isn't specific to any one religion or aspect of life. It's everywhere. The structural issue with what Josh is going to attempt here is that we live in a three-dimensional linear narrative that only exists as a cycle in structure. So when he attempts to symbolically wedge himself between the point of death and rebirth and remain there, it isn't going to happen in a cycle or circle. It's going to come in linear terms and go in a straight line. And that straight line will be the chimney flue. Now, as we've discussed, when a fetus enters this world, they do so nude, and when a young man begins the process of getting back inside the woman's body in a sexual context later in life after being expelled from it as a baby, both of these things are essentially done free of clothing. So here, even though it's cold that day, Josh is going to take off his clothes inside the cabin, as he is not indulging a rational narrative, rather, it's symbolic. Now, a fetus would be fully nude, but sex, or getting back inside in terms of being a man, would only require any nudity below the waist. In that light, Josh removes all of his clothes except his shirt. But we have to ask why he didn't remove the shirt if he is also indulging the narrative of getting back inside in the context of being back in the mother's womb prior to birth. Well, I think we have to consider that the specific type of shirt he is wearing is called a thermal, which symbolizes warmth in the same way as the fireplace. Now, in the previous episode, we talked about the concept of the redundant bees, or redundant bodies, which is the basis for the disunity between body and mind. A person has an emotional wound that has prevented their emotional growth, and so there exists disunity between the person they see in the mirror and the one that exists inside their head. So quite often, in these narratives, we find the presence of the redundant bees in a relevant place, normally near a source of heat. In the Phillip Island murders episode I just did, we had Beth and Fergus, two bodies, lying on the redundant bees of the beanbag and next to a heater. Here, in this story, Chuck Murphy will find that a breakfast bar, symbolizing the redundant bees, is torn off the wall on the other end of the cabin and placed in front of the source of heat in question here, meaning the fireplace. The redundant bees symbolize disunity between body and mind, and a person only rises or evolves to heal that disunity when they leave behind their old identity or old self that was holding them back, at which point that identity will finally disappear. So Josh places the redundant bees of the breakfast bar in front of the fireplace as it symbolizes the problem at hand. He couldn't leave his old self behind. He was emotionally stuck in the moment that his brother died, but physically moved forward to become someone else. Now it's in the fireplace that we burn embodiment in the form of wood, causing it to disappear to darkness, and at that point, we rise. So in an irrationally perpetrated narrative, Josh is saying that he is leaving that old self, the suffering one, or his emotional life behind, and will now physically rise. And he does that. He can't stop going back to that place of disunity emotionally, so he pulls the breakfast bar in front of the fireplace to prevent it from happening physically. He's saying he can't go back to that life. He can't go back to his old self. It's completely irrational, but structurally coherent from a design perspective. Now that he has gotten back inside, so to speak, to the place in which embodiment will be burned up, he plans to rise, but also position himself to be reborn as part of a cycle where he will endeavor to remain stagnant, as the only place in which this disunity will fail to occur is the beginning and end. Again, keep in mind that this would normally be in a cycle or circle, but must happen in linear terms or a straight line in a three-dimensional existence driven by the presence of time and space. Now that he has gotten back inside, he must position himself to both disappear and be reborn. That sounds ridiculous, right? But Josh is found upside down in the fetal position in the chimney flue, mimicking the position of a fetus on the verge of being reborn from the birth canal. Except, guess what? He's stuck there, intentionally. Meanwhile, below him is the fireplace, where the body or embodiment is burned up, meaning he has also or simultaneously positioned himself in a manner that says the body has been burned up, disappeared, and has risen, just like the process of Jesus to Holy Spirit to God, and will symbolically become disappearing white smoke, absent a body in totality, at the top. So he's positioned perfectly between death and rebirth, which is the only place in the infinite loop where there's silence and peace. And at its heart, that's the key to understanding this mystery. Josh could not find an emotional place where his suffering would end, so he found a physical one. Emotional places involve ideas and feelings which necessitate rational thought, but physical places require only structure. Emotions lead us to make choices born of rational thought, but structure dictates the nature of irrational thought. It's actually a pretty simple concept when you consider that a world absent emotional or psychological choices is literally one reduced to choices derived from design. On one hand, we have an emotional world that dictates the experiential aspects of our lives in terms of feelings and desires derived from perspective, and on the other, a physical one, or physics, which is a far more rigid and inflexible aspect of the universe's construction and functionality. So if you can't go on emotionally, sometimes you make a physical plan, like putting a gun to your head. But if you exhaust rational means of finding a way out, irrational means will come to bear by way of tragic fate. And I believe that's what happened here. So as we try to rationalize the events present in this story, we fail. But I think where a lot of people go wrong is that they demand this story to be dictated by rational terms and proceed to call the events inexplicable or suggest it had to be murder, despite the evidence. However, while occurrences such as these are quite rare in society as a whole, in the context of true crime, we have seen too many to count. When a person experiences a psychotic break from reality, it means they have been failed by reason and logic, so they proceed to abandon it. In life, we often tell each other to judge a person not by their words, but by their actions, as that will be the truth. That's because the world outside our heads and in front of our eyes is derived from endless variations and perspectives of reason and logic. But within our minds, absent the lies and necessity of pretending to be something we're not, there is a singular truth. And that truth here is that Josh Maddox could not go on with his life, nor could he go back. He was stuck. And through his voice and presence, he didn't want anyone else to know, as he was obviously a kind and gentle person who meant no harm, especially to his family. But in the end, our physical reality always has a symbiotic relationship with our emotional world. They parallel each other. So whatever we fail to say in words, ultimately it will be seen in our actions. And the emotional story that Josh Maddox tells here is that he was stuck in a cold, dark, and lonely place where he was subjected to prolonged suffering and agony that led to an emotional death. And therefore, it's how we end up finding him physically. But if there's a silver lining here, it's that he finally managed to find peace. In the end, there is simply no evidence supporting an accident or a murder, and what we owe Josh, as well as ourselves, is the effort to try to understand. So as we reach the end of this tale, I have to say that, without a doubt, there is a single idea or theme that resonates with me more than any other. And it occurs because Josh's actions parallel the emotional narrative here. Josh's family was left with a reality that he walked out the door one day and never returned. For 7 years, they were left to wonder where he had gone and if he would come back, both fearing the worst and hoping for the best, but always living with the greatest extent of uncertainty. I'm sure there were too many sleepless nights to count, and a true sense of peace was probably something they could not grasp, despite trying. All the while, their son was right down the road, only 2 blocks from their home. They had searched high and low, near and far, but came up empty. Yet here he was, just a short walk to a cabin they had probably all passed on too many occasions to count, unaware that it was his resting place. We understand that the family likely had differing experiences, with at least one person believing Josh might have succumbed to the same fate as his older brother Zach, while another preferred to think he had just taken off suddenly to start his life anew elsewhere. but no matter what they told themselves or others, surely there was one truth that was inescapable. When people we care about disappear from our lives, the distance from them might feel enormous or even unfathomable from a physical perspective. But what makes this process so difficult is that, on an emotional level, they're never far away. They're still right there by your side. We can see them in our minds, hear their voices or their laughter, and see their tears. We remember the good times, and the bad ones too. Yet regardless of how hard we try to forget and move on, they're with us. And it hurts because they're so close, right there in our minds where we can still see them so clearly. They're alive, looking right at us, and we feel it. Sometimes it's even much stronger than the feeling we had when they were alive. And all of our differences are gone. All of our disagreements settled. There is only love and the truth that even though it is still close, it's gone. That person is never coming back. And in this light, it is so tragic that Josh's emotional disposition displayed that theme perfectly in death. He was right there by his family the whole time, yet so far out of reach. But I think if there's a lesson to be learned from this tale, it has less to do with searching for others when they are lost, and is more concerned with what happens when we lose sight of ourselves, when we find ourselves hopeless and without a way forward, and feel like there's no place we can go. Because in those times, the best place to be is in the hearts and minds of others, and they in yours, so that for even just a fleeting moment in this painful and uncertain existence, we can finally understand we are not alone.